Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings be upon you. Good evening and thank you for tuning in to Radio Islam WCEV 1450 AM, Chicago, Illinois. I am Jamila Shiloh and we are a live call-in talk radio program airing every day from 6 to 7 p.m. Central. And we reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com where you can tap into all of our prior shows as well. To add to the conversation, call us at 312-263-ISLAM. That's 312-263-4752. And you can also post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/radioislam1450 or tweet us at radioislam1450. We are discussing comedy in the Islamic world with our guest, Azhar Usman. And before we get started, let me tell you a little bit about Azhar. Azhar is a stand-up comedian, actor, and writer, and a producer who is from Chicago. He currently has a one-man show at the Silk Road Theater called Ultra American, A Patriot Act. He has been performing for over a decade and has opened for Dave Chappelle over 50 times, one of my favorite comedians. And in addition to that, he has been named America's Funniest Muslim by CNN, which is an amazing honor. So, Azhar, first of all, congratulations. I heard the show is sold out.
Oh, my God. For tonight?
I don't know if it's for tonight. I heard it's been selling out, though. I don't want to start a rumor. But if you're listening right now, get your tickets.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. And I don't want to say it's sold out because I know it's not. I don't want people to buy tickets. We're doing 18 shows. We've already done four. I'm talking to you today. It's Saturday, the 10th of September. So it's the fifth show tonight. We'll still have 13 more throughout the month of September. And, you know, we sold out a few shows, but obviously we'd love the buzz to keep building. The reviews have been coming in. They've been overall fairly positive and wonderful things people are saying about the show. So we are very proud with the work, and I'm so indebted and so grateful to Silk Road Rising, in particular Jamil Khoury and Malik Jilani, who really took a risk on me, you know, because I'm not an actor, I'm not a playwright, I'm not a theater performer per se. You know, I come from a stand-up world. Stand-up is sort of this bastard child of the entertainment industry, and it doesn't quite fit in any of the neatly designed categories of theater or film or television, or, you know, it's kind of its own art form. And one of the secrets of stand-up, and one of the things I love so much about it, is that in many ways it really is the last bastion of free speech in the United States. And so as a comic, you know, basically the rule of thumb is very simple. As long as it's funny, you can say whatever you want, you know, whatever's on your mind. And so comedians have a very sort of unique license among the world of artists. And so for a theater company that, you know, has built very carefully and very systematically and very methodically an incredible reputation in the theater community, both with respect to the critics and the theater-going community, but also the industry side of it. I mean, there's the Jeff Awards, there's a whole infrastructure in place that sort of regulates and modulates the entire theater scene in Chicago. And for Malik and Jamil to be running a really critically acclaimed theater company like Silk Road Rising, and to invite somebody like me to do a solo show there, who has literally never done a play. You know, I did plays in high school, you know, but I haven't done a play. I haven't acted on the theater stage really into my entire career. I've really built my career doing stand-up. So it's been a really fun, exciting, amazing. We had a lot of beautiful moments with each other. We've had a lot of arguments and debates, and you know, everybody's very passionate about the work. So ultimately what's been coming out of all that is really just a show that we're all proud of. And finally, I would be remiss if I did not mention the director of the show, Aaron Todd Douglas, who has become really somebody I love very much. He's a creative partner. His fingerprints have now, you know, kind of showed up all over this show, and so it's become a really collaborative project.
That's amazing, Azhar. It sounds like you were accepting your Jeff Award right then and there. I feel like that was the speech that you're going to give.
The funny thing is, here's the funny thing. I never heard of the Jeff Award, and personally, I'm one of these people. Like, you know, one of my favorite acceptance speeches are like Larry David and Seinfeld. You know, just kind of almost like mocking, and this is not coming from an ugly place. It's just that I don't. Oh, interesting. My phone is ringing right now, and Hassan Minhaj, works for The Daily Show, very, very dear buddy of mine, is calling me. Do you mind if I patch him through?
Yeah, we'd love to have him.
Hold on, let's see what happens. Hold on.
And just so everyone knows what's going on, we are chatting with Azhar Osman, who's a comedian who currently has a show in Chicago called Ultra American, A Patriot Act. It's a one-man show, and he is catching
right.
in his friend Hassan Minhaj.
Jamila Shilo, and ladies and gentlemen of Radio Islam, my little brother and soul brother, and just a person I love very much. So Hassan Minhaj is on the line. He was calling me back just for context. Yeah, just for context, he's calling me back because I'm such a 40-year-old South Asian uncle now. I have not figured out how to send that audio file, like a large audio file from my phone to him. And he has been dying to hear the show to offer me some notes. So that's why he's been blowing up my phone. Hassan, I'm going to let you speak your mind, brother.
Hi, welcome to the show. We're excited to have you. Assalamu alaikum.
Well, you know, I want to come into this interview with positivity, but I have to say that Everybody has a Malcolm Gladwell tipping point to when they officially become an uncle. And Azhar Osman is essentially a baby uncle.
Is he?
He already had the fit. Now he has
the fit. Four kids. Listen, I'm a baby uncle. My oldest son is in high school, bro.
Are you starting, now that, like, are you starting to put pressure on him to get married? Like, you're getting old. When are you going to get married?
I'm already married. He's been my big brother for a long time, so I'm already married. But,
I met your son in high school. Sorry. I didn't mean you, Hassan.
I speak to my children about, you know, I have a very simple policy about parenting. And I think this is a problem among particularly South Asians, but in general, I think Muslim cultures, and when I say South Asians, I mean South Asian Muslims, but also I've noticed this with, you know, the Hindu community, Indian Christian community. There is this notion that somehow parents own their children, as if the children are your property. And it's my own spiritual belief that this is a misperception of reality. You know, you actually are just shepherding your kids, but, they, you know, God owns them, and they're going to go on to do whatever they're going to do. So the notion of one's self-worth being wrapped up in, you know, my kids have to be perfect, and they have to have the perfect education, and they have to behave perfectly, otherwise somehow I failed as a parent, is utter nonsense. I embrace a philosophy that says, you know, do the best you can to, imbibe the values and the ideas and the teachings that you would like your children to live their life according to. But recognize that at some point, like, they got to live their own life. So I talk to my kids about everything.
Oh, that's a great philosophy. I think you sound like a really good dad.
Well, I try to be, but I'm also very lazy. I'm missing the soccer games right now to talk to you.
Oh,
keep it 100.
Yeah, well, okay, thank you for neglecting your children in order to talk with us. Hassan, I'm so glad that you were able to join us. It sounds like you want to hop off, or do you have something else to say?
No. I'm going to hop off. This is very rude.
Can you please put in your words of encouragement to these listeners to buy tickets and come to the show?
Because this is going to play I'm just saying this completely unbiased, from an unbiased perspective. I'm very critical of myself and of others, and I am so proud that Azhar is doing this show. This is a must-see show. I've only seen the workshop iteration of what could be the inspiration jumping-off points for the show. So to actually see the show with lighting, with sound cues, with a real sort of theatrical experience, you have to see the show. You have to see the show.
That is an excellent
endorsement. You're flying in to see it, isn't that right?
Yes.
Oh, nice. A celebrity endorsement from Hassan Minhaj from
there
The Daily Show.
Hassan Minhaj, and then flying Hassan in to see the show.
Hello.
Okay, you guys get back to it.
And we lost them. All right, hold on 1 second. We unfortunately lost our two friends, Hassan and Azhar. Our producer, Olivia, is going to call Azhar back in. Oh, looks like he is back on the line. We're so excited to have him. Azhar, where did you go?
Yeah, that was weird. Sorry about that technology.
No worries. I'm telling you. But listen, so we talked a little bit to your friend. We heard about your technology problems. What I'd like to talk about is a little bit more about you. First of all, give me your background. Tell me about your path to comedy.
Oh, my path to comedy. All right. Okay. So I think that here's how I'd like to play it, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I'll give you the very, because the other thing about it is I also feel like people can also read it on Wikipedia. You know what I mean? Like, why should we waste precious time not talking about ideas? Let's talk about ideas instead of these.
I would love to talk
factual history. But I'll give you the brief sketch. I mean, I was born in Chicago. My parents are from India. I was raised in a Sunni Muslim family. I went to public school my whole life, first in the city of Chicago. Then we moved to Skokie when I was about 7 or 8. I went to high school at Niles West High School. I went to undergraduate at University of Illinois Chicago, where I studied communication and Spanish. I then went to the University of Minnesota for a law degree. Graduated from there in 1999. Started an internet company while I was in law school. Ran that for a couple years with my co-founder, a guy called Anas Osman, who's a very important community leader as well. He's one of the co-founders of the Pillars Fund. He's an executive at Google nowadays in his day job. And he and I also, with his brother Osama Osman, were founders of the Nabawi Foundation, which is an important Muslim, almost like think tank or thought leadership institute that was headed by Dr. Omar Farouk Abdullah for many years. So us and I started an internet company. We did that for a couple years. 2001, basically late 2000, early 2001 is when I started doing stand-up. I'd always wanted to try it. I had a friend in law school in Minnesota who was an amateur comic. I used to go and watch him at the open mics. And like a comedy voyeur, I wanted to try it, but I just didn't have the courage. So finally, late 2000, early 2001 is when I went on stage. It was pre-9/11. And then it was around the same time we sold our internet company. I didn't get rich or anything, but I had enough money where I could, you know, just sort of live for several months without having to have a day job. And my wife, who's an attorney, she graduated from law school around the same time. This is 2001. So she and I studied for the bar together and just had, you know, really kind of a wonderful summer leading up to taking the bar. She was also pregnant with our first son, Zaid, who ended up being born in January 2002. And so I ended up selling the internet company, had my own law practice for a few years, but I was doing stand-up, sort of moonlighting as a comic and running my law firm as my day job. Fast forward, 9/11 happens. I stopped doing stand-up for a few months. I was just focusing on really doing community work. I was lecturing a lot, going to churches and temples and you know, universities and libraries and doing media interviews, just like all the Muslim leaders, basically, of the community were called upon to suddenly be thrust into the media spotlight because the United States of America sort of suddenly woke up to the fact that there is this multi-million-strong Muslim community in the United States that were not only the best source of information about Islam for their fellow Americans, but also were suddenly the targets of suspicion, backlash. They were the targets of allegations of being a fifth column in this country. Their patriotism was being questioned, et cetera, et cetera. So I did that for a few months, and then when I got back on stage, let's say, you know, spring 2002, suddenly there was a tremendous amount of interest in my career, in my stand-up, and I did that for a couple years, 02, 03, into 04. I was still just doing it part-time as a hobby, for fun, as a wannabe kind of artist, you know, just sort of my heart was in it, but I didn't have the courage, I didn't have the support, I didn't think I could make it as a comedian full-time, until 2004 came around. In 04, I had begun thinking about, very seriously, quitting my law practice and trying to go all in and pursue my stand-up career, and that was based on two things. Number one, I was legitimately falling in love. I mean, imagine the same feelings you feel when you are just utterly compelled to pursue a person that you're in love with. Similarly, I was basically falling in love with stand-up, and I just couldn't not do it. And then number two, more importantly, to be honest with you, was the fact that I was getting booked by a lot of Muslim organizations who were flying me out, paying me, you know, $500, $1,000, $1,500 sometimes to come and do stand-up for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And I felt like I was cheating them because I was like, man, I'm not a professional. I don't even know what I'm doing. And I'm doing this for fun and for a hobby. And it started really eating away at my conscience. And I thought to myself, you know, either I got to stop doing this, or I got to really do it. I got to go all in, and I got to become a comedian. And so around that time, I was literally trying to figure out how to make it work financially and everything else. And then I got a call from a gentleman who's called Preacher Moss, the founder of the Allah Made Me Funny Tour, and he had just heard about me in the Muslim community circles. And so he reached out and said, look, I'm thinking about doing this comedy showcase called Allah Made Me Funny. I want it to be a touring showcase of American Muslim comedians. I've heard your name in a lot of different circles. Would you be interested? So I said, you know, you're an answer to my prayers, because I've been trying to figure out a way to, you know, kind of pivot into stand-up. So I said, you know, let's go for it. So we met. He happened to be in Chicago a few days later. We shook on it. And then, as they say, the rest is history. I shut down my law practice. We began touring. We thought, as a modest target, if we did about 20 shows in the next 2 years, big shows, we thought that would be successful. We ended up doing 50 shows the first year.
Wow.
And it was just suddenly became a, you know, a situation. We got the press was very good to us. We got a lot of media coverage. And suddenly, you know, there was interest from overseas. And then we found ourselves touring the UK. We found a promoter over there we toured with for a few years. And then that led to another promoter in Australia bringing us out. So we ended up doing Australia and New Zealand in, I think, 2005 or 6. We then did South Africa a few years later. We did Australia again. We did the UK, and then eventually went into other Scandinavian countries. A promoter in Amsterdam brought us out to the Netherlands. We did 5 cities in the Netherlands. We did Copenhagen, Denmark. We did Sweden, Malmo, Sweden, Stockholm. So this tour suddenly became a globally touring brand. And, of course, in 2006, we crossed paths with Mohammed Amer, the famous Mo Amer, who's really regarded to be the top Arab comic in the world. He is Dave Chappelle's, one of his favorite openers. He's worked with him over 100 times. He has a brand new comedy special that, alhamdulillah, all praise to God, I was able to be involved with as a producer. And that special was directed by Jay Chapman. Jay Chapman has directed over 50 stand-up specials in his career. So Mo Amer is about to make some moves in the industry. And, in fact, he and I started a production company together called Kali Jaga Media, which is focused on creating original content. So, yeah, we got a lot going on. That's what's up.
That's great. And that is excellent, I would say, table setting for our next round of conversation, which we're about to have. But before we do, we're going to need our listeners to stay with us, because after the break, Radio Islam will continue this conversation with Azhar Osman, and we will talk more about his one-man show, Ultra American, A Patriot Act, at the Silk Road Rising Theater. There's still time to share your thoughts and questions on our program, so please remember to call in at 312-263-ISLAM. That's 312-263-4752.
This is the sound of a flat-screen television hurled off a building. Now the new bike your kid wants. These are the things you could have, all cast into oblivion. Because when you throw away money on wasted electricity, you throw away everything you could have bought with it. Use Energy Star light bulbs and appliances, and you could save hundreds of dollars a year. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
This is a guided meditation on parenting. Take a deep breath in and let go of the time you and your son played basketball and you attempted to slam dunk. Or when you hit that piñata into your neighbor's yard. Let it go.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago. We reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com, where you can also review all of our prior shows. Radio Islam is a live call-in talk show on the air every night from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time. Our call-in number is 312-263-ISLAM. That's 312-263-4752. And you may also add to the conversation by posting on our wall at facebook.com/radioislam1450 or tweeting us at radioislam1450. And we are talking to Azhar Osman, who is a Muslim stand-up comic and has been performing for over a decade. And Azhar, so I actually have a disclaimer. I was also a Silk Road Theater soloist. My show was in November.
Congratulations, by the way. That's amazing. I heard wonderful things about it. I didn't get to see it. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
But I heard amazing things. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad that people are saying good things about it. I kind of want to talk to you about the process from doing stand-up comedy, which I feel like is a conversation to the audience, to theater, which is more of a conversation with the audience. And how was that transition for you?
To go from stand-up into this theater world?
Yeah,
you know, it's been so much challenging, but it's been a wonderful challenge for me, because, you know, stand-up is such an unstructured art form. there, you know, the famous thing about it is sort of there's no rules. And of course, there are conventions and there are techniques and there's a craft. You know, stand-up is a very beautiful art form that I've immersed myself in for so long. And so to go from that world where I'm so natural in that environment and I feel like, you know, a fish swimming in water, and then to sort of be taken out of that water and put into, you know, to ask to be a bird who's not going to fly instead. And the theater has, you know, it's actually a good analogy because to fly, you have to really be precise. And it requires a lot more precision in terms of fidelity to the script, for example, fidelity to the stage blocking because it, you know, coordinates with the lights and the sound, the cues and everything else. So it's been really challenging for me to learn, you know, kind of learn on the fly and try my best to remember the old training I had. I mean, I was in high school plays. In fact, I had a solo in a play called The Apple Tree that had three cast members, Adam, Eve, and the snake. You can guess who I was.
Eve.
Try again.
I feel like you might have been the snake. I'm a little concerned.
I was the snake. Yeah. I was the snake. I wore a tuxedo. I had a solo. You know, I had a dance, a song and dance routine where I was attempting to seduce Adam and Eve to eat from the tree. So I have done some theater years ago, but obviously I've been out of that world forever, and I certainly never did it at such a professional level. So it's been really exhilarating. It's been really creative. It's been an explosion of creativity for me, pun intended. And it's been just an amazing experience. I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah, and we're grateful that you're doing it. I personally love the Silk Road Theater. I think that it's one of the warmest and best environments for somebody to start doing theater in and to continue doing theater in. I think that they really foster a world where you can explore your ideas and you can openly explore them and they don't censor you. So we're so grateful that something like that exists. But one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is in your show, you explore a lot of ideas that we generally don't hear. And one of the ideas that you start the show by saying, a lot of you people in the audience have never seen someone like me smile. And I think that's such such an interesting point to make because it's true. We're represented, Muslims in general in the media are represented as so miserable and so angry and so unhappy that when we see one smile, it's almost a shock to our system. It sort of rocks people's worlds. I want you to talk to me a little bit about how you wanted yourself to be represented on stage and what you hope will come of this show, what people will think of.
Sure. So, I mean, really the heart of the show, or I would say the format of the show from a creative standpoint is basically to put in the form of jokes, to deliver in the form of jokes, you know, a treatment of big ideas. So in the show, you know, we talk about cognitive framing. I mean, that joke is about cognitive frames, the fact that people don't associate and are shocked, basically, Muslims themselves as well, by seeing a bearded Muslim man smiling is a function of the unconscious cognitive frames, the paradigms of the time we're living in, which are largely manufactured by media, by mass media. And so there's a commentary there basically on the fact that the very notion of you've never seen someone who looks like me smile before returns in the show much later on when I talk about the six mega media companies, the conglomerates, that own and operate well over 90% of the mass media in the United States. And then at the end of the show, I literally say, that's why it's called television programming, because people have been programmed by those six companies to see me and fear me. So it's a commentary on cognitive frames. And in fact, at one point I even say, here's a little thing you don't know about me, before I became a comedian, I used to be an attorney. Surprise! Adjust your cognitive frames. So is a very subtle, there's a lot of subtle threads throughout the show that are really treatments of big ideas. Similarly, you know, there's discussion about religious fundamentalism. You know, it's my own personal journey in my relationship with God and religious teaching, prophecy, scripture, etc., that so much of the discourse surrounding religion in the time we're living in is actually not, has nothing to do with classical traditional religion. It has to do with identity politics. And in many ways, so many of the voices speaking on behalf of Islam or the Muslim community, quote-unquote, they're really not religious people per se. They're actually what I would call identity politicians. And so much of the activist work being done on behalf of Muslim civil rights or Muslim community engagement and Muslim political engagement, et cetera, while important, and I support all of it, and many of my very dear friends are involved in that work, at the same time, they are identity politicians. They're not religious leaders or teachers. Many of those people, by their own admission, you know, they don't even pray. They may drink alcohol. They may openly, you know, fornicate and flagrantly violate the rules of the religion because they're secular people, and that's fine, but they should not be then propped up as religious teachers. We should understand that religion is about God, morality, spirituality, and the cleansing of the heart. It has nothing to do with being a special interest group in the United States that wants to lobby against Trump and get Hillary Clinton into office. Those are concerns that are at a socio-political dimension that have to do with our survival as a community in the prophetic mission that the final messenger of God, which I believe is a Muslim, was sent to Earth to invite human beings to return to their Lord. So the show also has this commentary and exploration of the difference between Islam, the actual spiritual religious wisdom teaching, and Christianity and Judaism and other religions, versus the political versions of these religions that are sort of the dominant discourse in the time we're living in. So at the top of the show, I make this point and I say, you know, I am a Muslim, traditionalist in my outlook, living an utterly modern life. In many ways, I'm a believing secular Muslim, like most believers nowadays. And then I explore what that means to me, the fact that when I say I believe in God, I'm talking about God, not some, you know, some new agey, you know, Deepak Chopra, Tony Robbins, Eckhart Tolle kind of nonsense. Like, oh, energy, God is energy and love. Yeah, God is energy and love because God is all there is, but we're talking about God, the infinite, the one God with infinite names, the absolute infinity. So, yeah, there's a lot of spirituality in the show. There's Sufi wisdom teaching that is also mentioned. We have a reference to the metaphor of the bird in a cage that is inspired from a line from a poem by Imam al-Ghazali, who is called Al-Ghazal in Western philosophy, and he is considered Hujjat al-Islam, the proof of Islam, by the Muslim community. And Imam al-Ghazali, the legend goes, he had a premonition of his own death. And so he knew he was going to die. His brother, Ahmed al-Ghazali, rahmatullahi alayhi, may God have mercy on him, discovered the body of his of Imam al-Ghazali the next morning. And under his pillow was a poem that he had written. And in this poem, Imam al-Ghazali says, you know, do not, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but do not mourn over this body, for this body is not me. He says, you know, I was the pearl, and this is the clam that I've left behind. This body was the raiment, the garment that I wore when I was in the world. And then the last metaphor he uses, he says, this is the cage. I was the bird, and this is the cage. And I have now flown and left my cage. And I found that metaphor is so powerful and beautiful, so it became a part of my show. And then at the end of the show, when we close out the whole show, in fact, the last line is that, you know, when I get a chance to perform around the world, I have to be honest, I don't even see the cages anymore. I just see a beautiful conference of birds. And that's, of course, a reference to the famous Sufi poem by Fariduddin Attar, one of the teachers of Maulana Rumi. And he's written a beautiful epic poem called The Conference of the Birds, Mantiq al-Tayr, which is a deep, deep mystical Sufi poem about inner knowledge and the spiritual path. So and then, of course, there's also a quote of Sheikh Abul Hasan al-Shadhili, the eponymous founder of the Shaykhwa of Sufism, of Tasawwuf, in which he says the Sufi sees his own existence like particles of dust made visible by a ray of sunlight, neither real nor unreal. And immediately after that, we make the statement, we are living in an imaginary existence. And people may think that's a joke, but that's a real mystical school. Wahdat al-Wujud, the mystical spiritual school of Sheikh al-Akbar, who postulates that this entire created world is really nothing more than sort of a projection or an imagination. It's an imaginary world. It is simultaneously real but not real. And this is a minority view among mystics of Islam, but it is a mystical school, and it's not to be confused with, you know, the competing sort of companion or supplemental viewpoint that says actually it's not wahdat al-wujud, it's not that there's a unity of being, it's wahdat al-shuhud, it's the unity of perception of being, and this is the school of Allahumma salli ala nabi, of Sheikh Ahmed Sirhindi, you know, he's known as Mujaddid Al-Fasani. So these are deeply mystical ideas and doctrines that have been debated for 1,000 years in the history of Islam. And what this fakir has attempted to do is, through the vehicle of a comedy show, introduce a spiritual dimension into what we're talking about so that we can try to raise the level of our discourse, understanding, and perception so that we're not just stuck all the time in the realm of the socio-political debates, which dominate our discussions, but rather to recognize that all of those tensions are meant, in fact, to get us to a higher plane and to begin to see one another and even ourselves not as physical beings on a spiritual journey, but rather spiritual beings on a physical journey. You are not a body that happens to have a soul. In truth, you are a soul that happens to have a body.
Ashar, I'm so glad that you're here to talk with us about this. I feel like we can feel your passion and your knowledge come through over the radio. So thank you so much for that. We do have to go to break. So stay with us. After the break on Radio Islam, we'll continue our conversation with Ashar Usman, who has a show currently at the Silk Road Theater called Ultra American, A Patriot Act. There's still time to share your thoughts and questions on our program. So please remember to call 312-263-ISLAM. That's 312-263-4755.
Would your business survive a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency, and 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago, and reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com, where you can also review all of our prior shows. Radio Islam is a live call-in show on the air every night from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time. Our call-in number is 312-263-ISLAM, and that's 312-263-4752. And you may also add to the conversation by posting on our wall at facebook.com/radioislam1450 or tweeting us at radioislam1450. Ashar, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for being here with us. Ashar, do we still have you on the line?
Thank you.
Oh, good, good. I thought we lost you. I'm so glad you're still here.
I put it on mute because I had my window down. Sorry.
Oh, no worries. I kind of want to talk to you a little bit about the music on the show. So I noticed that you had a lot of artists like Brother Ali playing in between the segments, and there was sort of a hip-hop vibe happening. Why? Why choose that music? And talk to me a little bit about your history with those different artists.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, hip-hop is arguably the third indigenous art form in from the United States. I mean, the two that are universally regarded to be indigenous American art forms are jazz and stand-up comedy.
Oh.
And so hip-hop is sort of the third, although, you know, some would argue that it really emerges from the jazz history. But anyway, I grew up listening to hip-hop. You know, I remember my first Public Enemy album when I was probably about 13 or 14, and it just changed my life. You know, reading the liner notes that begin with, "In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the merciful." I mean, I just was hooked. And I grew up on, you know, on DMC, on Public Enemy, on, you know, on NWA, on Ice Cube. On, and then I went through, and those are the early guys that I was in love with. Then, you know, I kind of went through my Salafi phase when I was kind of more of a literalist in my religious, my relationship with religion. Sometime in the 90s, and during that time, I was one of these people that was like, you know, I got to get music out of my life. This is all evil for me and bad and all that. So I kind of missed the Tupac, Biggie era. I missed Eminem. I missed Dr. Dre. I missed kind of like a chunk. But it was, to me, looking back on it, it was kind of good because when I got back into hip-hop, I was like, I clearly understood the difference between commercial garbage, vacuous, vapid, pop nonsense versus the kind of underground artists like Mos Def, A.K.A. Yasin Bey, you know, Talib Kweli, you know, Brother Ali, of course, who became one of my best friends, and then many other artists that I just love, too many to name right now, many of whom are critically acclaimed but not ultra-famous because they never really went down a commercial path. And so my relationship with these artists is that, you know, stand-up in many ways, and certainly stand-up from my vibe, my generation, obviously Dave Chappelle has played a huge influence on my art and on my work, and he is very much located in the same cultural space as many of the great hip hop musicians. In fact, you know, Kanye blew up off his show. You know, Kanye West's first TV appearance was on the Chappelle Show. So, you know, being able to just hang out with Dave so often over the last 11 years and, you know, kind of talk to him about art and about hip-hop and about music and about comedy and stand-up, you know, just left an indelible imprint on the fact that there is, in my view, and certainly in my form of stand-up, my flavor of stand-up, there's an intimate relationship between hip-hop and this type of stand-up. And lastly, I'll also say, you know, regarding the Islam connection, historians and commentators who study hip-hop academically have written books about how there is a relationship between Islam and hip-hop. Islam has been called the unofficial religion of hip-hop. In fact, one of my friends, Professor, I'm forgetting his name at the moment, slipping my mind, Suhail Dawladzai from UCLA has written a book about this, and in fact has a book project and a museum exhibition called The Return of the Mecca, which documents the detailed history of the relationship between hip-hop and Islam. There's another brother, a Bangladeshi brother, Abdul Mohamed, I'm forgetting his first name. He's written academic articles about the relationship between hip-hop and Islam. My friend Suad Abdul Khabir has a book coming out through an academic press also about hip-hop and Islam. So there is a very, very deep historical, artistic, cultural overlap and inextricable link between the vibe and the cultural milieu from which so much wonderful and amazing is coming. And I'm telling you that my show, in many ways, is located within the same universe.
Okay, so it sort of lives in this Islamic hip-hop universe. I guess what I'm asking is are you a product of Islam, hip-hop, and comedy all coming together? Is your show
That's
a product
so funny
of that?
That you said that. Oh, my God, it's amazing. So since you're a radio host, you'll appreciate this. Brother Ali, who is, you know, clearly a very, very well-respected rapper, mm-hmm. and alhamdulillah, by the grace of God, you know, I've been very blessed in my life to be able to, you know, build a career in stand-up and garner a lot of respect from my peers. So the two of us have been planning a podcast together.
Oh, wow.
And it's called Life to America. It's a podcast about literally what you said, God, hip-hop, comedy.
Wow, I think that is so amazing, and I would love to hear more about it. But before we do, we have to go to break again, so I need everyone to stay with us. And after the break on Radio Islam, we'll continue this conversation with Azhar Osman, and we'll talk more about his show at the Silk Road Theater, Ultra American, A Patriot Act, which is running right now, so get your tickets right away. And there's still time to share your thoughts and questions on our program. So please remember to call in 312-263-ISLAM. That's 312-263-4752.
Hey, Dad, how do you throw a curveball? How do you build a fort? How do refrigerators run? How do fish learn how to swim?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
How high can you jump?
But you don't have to know every answer.
How many phone numbers are there?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
How do cell phones work?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
What's electricity?
They just need you.
What's the moon made of?
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago. We reach the world by streaming at radioislam.com, where you can also review all of our prior shows. Radio Islam is a live call-in talk show on the air every night from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time. Our call-in number is 312-263-ISLAM. That's 312-263-4752. And you may also add to the conversation by posting on our wall at facebook.com/radioislam1450 or tweeting us at radioislam1450. And we are talking to Azhar Osman, who is a stand-up comic who currently has a one-man show at the Silk Road Rising Theater, Ultra American, A Patriot Act. Please make sure that you check out this show and get your tickets. He explores ideas and topics that are not generally addressed in the mainstream media, particularly by people who are Muslim or of Islamic descent, or even are just looking for a new view on things that they've read and heard about. And one of the things actually that really struck me about your show that I really, really loved was you had a scene where you talked about the temptations in the the Garden of Eden using the slogans from different fast food companies. How did something like that, what was your thought process in creating something like that? How did it come about?
Sure, sure. So the background of that segment is the fact that I've been obsessed for many years now with the relationship between miracles and magic. Because those who believe in God, basically the essence of believing in God is really to, if you boil it down, is to believe in the miraculous. In other words, something which is beyond the scope of rationality. And magic is sort of the counterfeit version of a miracle. So the Quran and the Bible and the Old and New Testament tell the story of Moses going into the court of Pharaoh, where the magicians of the Pharaoh, who have basically mesmerized the people through either what's called sihr in Arabic, black magic, dark magic, or even just illusions, you know, tricking them, they have fooled the people into believing in the Pharaoh as a legitimate authority, although he is, of course, an illegitimate authority. Because the Pharaoh is an archetype of a false god who claims to the people, "Ana Rabbukum al-A'la," I am your Lord, the Most High. And this is obviously the highest form of rebellion against God, to call oneself a god. So magicians were playing this role of tricking the people into accepting an illegitimate authority. And then Moses is sent to expose their magic for what it is, which is falsehood. And he does this by sort of beating them at their own game, except the difference is he's not doing a magic trick, he's performing a miracle. And whereas they are doing what they're doing on their own authority, he says, on the contrary, I do nothing here. You know, I'm given a command by God to throw the staff, and God performs the miracle at my hand. So the difference between a miracle and a magic trick, although they produce the same result, they appear the same. They're violating the rules and conventions of causation, and they cause what's called ta'ajjub, absolute and complete bewilderment in the mind of the viewer. They are actually, in fact, grounded in two fundamentally different realities. And this is important to understand because even the Prophet Muhammad, who comes as a final messenger of God and performs miracles, people see him, and those who refuse to believe in him, all they can say is, he's the greatest magician from the east to the west. In other words, the only way they can rationally sort of reconcile what he's doing, and most notably dropping these verses that are, you know, as a man who never went to got formal education and schooling, how is he dropping these incredible verses that become the Quran in an environment where poetry is so respected as the highest art form? So the relationship between miracles and magic is something that's been really in my heart for many years. Now, I say all that to say, when I began learning about Aleister Crowley, who is mentioned in the show as well, and his, you know, the entire world that he comes from, which is a world of occultism.
Yeah, he's the father of black magic.
Not the father of, but yeah, certainly he coined the term magic, M-A-G-I-C-K, with a K at the end. And magic, that type of magic, is basically a black magic, what we would call sihr in classical religion. And he then is a person who advocates what he calls invocation and evocation of demons, of jinn. And, you know, he talks about how method acting is the quickest way to summon, you know, a spirit being inside yourself. He does, everything I mentioned in the show is all factually true. He did go to Egypt in 1904. He did claim to receive a revelation over a course of 3 days from a spirit being called Awas, which he claimed was a revelation that he wrote down that became what's called the Liber Aegis, or the Book of the Law. And then he founded a religion based on that book called Thelema, and another world organization called the OTO, the Ordo Templo Orientis, which then becomes the foundation of this teaching. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And this is really the default teaching of most pop culture these days, because do what thou wilt, do whatever you want, is the book of the law. In other words, this is the highest order of law, is the worship of the human will. The religion, he named his religion Thelema, which is from Greek word thelem, which means will. So he basically believed in the idea that you can create your own world by simply recognizing the power of your ability to will whatever you want into being. Now, the thing is, this mystical teaching is true. I do believe that a human being can will whatever it is they want and desire into being. That is true. And that is what all authors of the modern New Age, modernist, secular, atheistic ideology, whether it's Oprah or Deepak Chopra or Eckhart Tolle or Tony Robbins or even, I would say, Ram Dass to a degree, or, you know, World Works, or, you know, Mankind Project, or there's so many of them now. They're all teaching the same New Age, you know, spiritualism that is a remixing of this ancient mystical teaching, which is that you can create your own reality, minus the most important element, which is God himself. So teach people that you're a God, but not that you are not God himself, is to me one of the highest forms of a rebellion against God. And it is a perversion that is so pervasive nowadays, people just embrace it as if it's, you know, this beautiful teaching. Like, oh, yeah, you know, live your best life, Oprah Winfrey. Like, yeah, that's all nice and wonderful, but if you don't accept the fundamental notion that every prophet of God taught, which is you are not God, you're a human being. God is God, man is man. Man is not God, God is not man. The reason man should worship God is because the world ends one day and there's an accountability, a judgment is coming. Every prophet in the history of the world, if you boil down the essential teaching of deen, of religion, it is these two elements. God is one, you should worship him. Number two, the world's ending, there will be a judgment. So the fact that they have divorced people, human beings, from these core ideas that are the basis of all collected human wisdom tradition and all classical religion throughout all of time, across all human civilizations, and they have introduced into the world this utterly perverted notion. How did they do it? Well, they did it through this magic. So I began studying magic. Now, in magic, magicians use what are called sigils, S-I-G-I-L. And a sigil is a visual representation that is a condensation of the magical spell that the magician wants to put out into the world. And so logos, corporate logos and brands, are actually viral sigils. And this has been written about by magicians. I can send you a link to an article. You can put it on your website as notes to this interview, because I'm mentioning a lot of content here. But it's an article called Pop Magic. And it's by a gentleman, I think his name is, I can pull up the reference because I have it in my phone. But in any case, it's a detailed article in which he talks about this pop magic. And he literally has a whole section talking about viral sigils and corporate brands and how these corporate brands are. Can I read you a small passage? Would you be interested?
Yeah, go for it.
The viral sigil, also known as the brand or logo, is not a recent development. See Christianity, the Nazis, and any flag of any nation. But rather has become an inescapable global phenomenon in recent years. It's easy to see the Nazi movement as the last gasp of imperial age thinking. The visionary savages still thought world domination meant tramping over the enemy, quote-unquote, and seizing his real estate. If only they'd had the foresight to see that global domination has nothing to do with turf and everything to do with media, they would have anticipated corporate stealth violence methods and combined them with the undoubted design sense. The rejected artists who engineered the Third Reich might have created the 10th century's first global super brand and spared the lives of many potential consumers. The McDonald's golden arches, the Nike swoosh, and the Virgin autograph are all corporate viral sigils. Corporate sigils are super breeders. They attack unbranded imaginative space. They invade Red Square. They infest the cranky streets of Tibet. They etch themselves into hairstyles. They breed across clothing, turning people into advertising hoardings. They are a very powerful development in the history of sigil magic, which dates back to the first bison drawn on the first cave wall. The logo or brand, like any sigil, is a condensation, a compressed symbolic summoning up of the world of desire which the corporation intends to represent. The logo is the only visible sign of the corporate intelligence seething behind it. Walt Disney died long ago, but his sigil, that familiar cartoonist signature, persists, carrying its own vast weight of meanings, associations, nostalgia, and significance. People are born and grow up to become Disney executives, mouthing jargon and the credo of a living corporate entity.
So it's sort of your...
Frozen.
Oh.
It's almost done. It's almost done.
Okay,
it's almost done.
Sorry. I apologize.
Walt Disney, the man, is long dead and frozen, or so folk myth would have it. But Disney, the immense invisible corporate egregore, persists. Corporate entities are worth studying and can teach the observant magician much about what we really mean when we use the word magic. They and other ghosts like them rule the world of the early 21st century.
Are you all good?
Yeah. So
good.
To me, the segment on the devil and the brands and the logos and ending with Apple, literally a picture of an apple with a bite taken out, is a commentary on connecting the dots between this magical spell that we're all under and the fact that, you know, we've all succumbed to it and we don't even know.
I think that makes a lot of sense because I've recently been reading a lot about just in general how branding and large corporations sort of use forms of mind control to keep people sort of, I don't want to use the word enslaved, but sort of enslaved within, you know.
I'll use the word enslaved.
You can use the word enslaved, but there's sort of a propaganda machine that happens and it sort of keeps people within, in check and within line. And if you're constantly within the race of trying to purchase, work to buy, work to sort of climb up this corporate ladder, but there's really no end to what you're climbing to. So at the end of the day, there's no place that you can achieve because they're telling you that the more you try to achieve these levels, the closer you'll be to being astaghfirullah God. So it's an important topic to discuss because I feel like people don't realize we are very much blinded by branding, really. We're blinded by the media. We're blinded by advertising. But it goes even more than that because it becomes ingrained to you. From the time that you're a baby, when you're eating Gerber cereal, you are part of that system. So it takes a lot to sort of be woke and wake up from that. And I think the reason that particular sketch that you did in your show struck me so much is that no one really talks about that. And I think that there's a lot of other subjects that nobody really talks about. One of the things that you talked about in your show was conspiracy theories. So I really like the take that you did on it because you sort of said, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and then slowly listed some of the conspiracy theories that you had heard over the years. Are you a little bit of a conspiracy theorist? Like, what is – and I hate to call it a conspiracy theorist because it automatically puts it into a realm of a little bit of mockery, like, oh, look at these crazy conspiracy theorists.
That's right.
But I think more so that people who are conspiracy theorists are willing to not just listen to the stories that are told to them by the media. They more so are willing to think that maybe there is a different – way, a different story, a different truth that's out there, and they are looking to seek that truth. Is that how you would describe yourself?
Kind of. I think that is, I take a more bird's eye view. And what I mean by that is, you know, instead of, part of what happens with conspiracy theorists, let's take Alex Jones, for example, you know? Alex Jones, probably America's, you know, most well-known, quote-unquote, conspiracy theorist. You know, this is the guy from InfoWars. And, you know, the guy, he ends up becoming almost a parody of himself and ends up saying such insane-sounding and ridiculous, crazy-sounding things precisely because he, you know, I would argue because he is somebody who doesn't have a grounding in his own epistemological framework. You know, epistemology is very important to get right. If you don't know why you believe something is true, then you don't have a basis to determine. You don't have a criteria to judge any new idea against to figure out how you're going to process the truth or falsity of any given claim. And it's much more easy. It's much easier then to get seduced by, quite frankly, crazy, ridiculous conspiracy ideas that are not grounded in reality, but rather are phantasms of one's own imagination. Now, having said that, what I don't like about our culture is people tend to dismiss, quote-unquote, conspiracy theories as though anybody who would question the official stories.
Sorry to interrupt. Yes. Just to clarify, when you say our culture, do you talk about Muslim culture? Do you mean American culture?
That's a great question. Thank you for clarifying. Well, when I said it a moment ago, I meant American culture.
Okay.
And it's funny because Muslim culture has a rule, and Muslims, certainly in the Muslim world, kind of have the opposite tendency, which is to too readily embrace conspiracy theories. You know, as if the Jews and the America and the Jews are behind everything, right? Everything bad happening to Muslims is because, you know, Israeli Zionists control the world and they control America and they just they want to kill us all and keep the Arabs down and that's why we can't get anything done and that's why our civilizations and our society suck and you know we have no we're not to blame at all, we're innocent victims in all this and we take no responsibility for our own agency in creating the
control over our own path.
Yeah, we have no control over we're not autonomous actors. We're not given free will like everyone. It's insane. So this is an interesting note. You're giving me an interesting insight into the radically divergent psychologies of, you know, what I'm going to call American culture as a rule, which is highly skeptical of conspiracy theories, versus Muslim culture as a rule, which is highly susceptible to conspiracy theories. It's a very interesting insight. So when I said that a moment ago, I was speaking as an American. I would say in our culture as Americans, we tend to be highly skeptical of conspiracy theorists. And I would actually argue what I'm arriving at here is, yet again, as an American Muslim, I think the answer is somewhere in the middle. You know, every conspiracy theory is not true, obviously, but every conspiracy theory is not BS either. There is truth because it's not paranoia if they're really out to get you.
That is true. It's definitely not paranoia if they're really out to get you. And coming back to that a little bit and coming back to your show, actually, this show is it's a comedy. It has serious moments, but it's a comedy and you're a funny person. Now, we've spoken about a lot of serious subjects here on the show.
Yes.
But I want to end it on a little bit of a lighter note because I want to make sure that people attend and just see how charismatic you really are on stage and what an interesting perspective you bring to it. What do you believe is the funniest moment of your show? And can you tell me maybe one of your favorite jokes or favorite lines? And I know that's sort of a pat question, but like I said, we kind of want to end it on a positive note.
I have a problem with doing interviews now, I realize, because the expectation is always that the comedian is going to come on and be funny. And I'm a funny person, but I'm also like, I end the show with this quote from Sir Peter Ustinov where I say, comedy is simply a funny way of being serious.
Yeah.
And so I kind of feel like if they want to hear me be funny, come to the show. If you want to hear the ideas of the artist who made the comedy, then listen to the interview, which is serious. But that being said, I mean, obviously I love certain moments in the show very much. I would say my favorite part of the whole show, is probably, just from a straight funniness standpoint, I really think that the white civil rights movement section, you know, to me is a really funny take. I'm proud of that joke because I feel like nobody else did it, and it was right under everyone's nose.
Yeah.
To call what's happening in this country the birth of the white civil rights movement is just a really funny take. And sometimes, especially if I do it in a club environment, where it's just a different energy, as soon as I drop that line, you know, this country is witnessing, the line is, race in America is an open secret, which means in many ways, America is a racial paradox. And this paradox is exploding right before our eyes. We're witnessing the dawn of a new day, the birth of the white civil rights movement, headed by a great leader, Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the Martin Luther King of white people. And then it goes into the leadership of the white civil rights movement. And my favorite joke really in the whole show is, you know, the white civil rights movement is serious, baby. They have an agenda. Number one, gun rights. Number two, in case you missed it, more gun rights. Number three, we got to build this wall, keep these Mexicans out. They're all rapists and murderers. Going to come over here and rape everybody and murder everybody. What makes you say that? That's what we did. When you sneak into this country illegally, you got to rape everybody and murder everybody. Those are the rules. If you don't believe me, read a book about it called The People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. People don't read anymore. So, that's a joke that's sort of for me. Sometimes it crushes and sometimes it does lukewarm, but I know that I love that joke and I know how hilarious it is. So I'm very proud of that.
Well, we're very proud of you, and we're very excited to see. I saw your show. I thought it was great. I was there for the previews. My producer, Olivia, just saw your show. She thought it was fantastic. Actually, as you were talking, she was just nodding along and laughing. She loved it so much.
Oh, my God. Did you see it last night?
Did you see it last night, Olivia?
Yeah, I did, actually.
So last night, of the four I've done so far, last night, I think, was the one that most found its groove. And alhamdulillah, but all thanks to God, the people, you know, got to their feet and gave it up. For the show, and obviously that's always very humbling and very inspiring, quite frankly, because it makes me want to work even harder to make the show even better. I feel like it's not quite there yet. There's a couple of wrinkles that I'm trying to iron out. There are a couple of word choices and a couple of sentences. You know, there's been some reviews already written of the show, and most beneficial review that I read was a very critical one that gave a note, and that basically said that, you know, it's interesting because despite all my commenting on how others are projecting onto me, the truth is I'm also projecting onto them by feeling the need to apologize to anybody or feeling the need to soften the blow as if, you know, I can't assume that the audience that's paid money to come and see this show to see me perform is not already a self-selecting crowd that is not going to be offended by anything I have to say. And so as a result, I've decided to take out some of the disclaimers that I had baked in just to make it a little more palatable to whether it's white people or Jews or any segment of the community that I'm talking about. I don't want anybody. I'm not a comedian that is interested in hurting anybody. I'm not a comedian that's interested in attacking anybody. I'm not a shock comic. I don't do comedy just to produce laughter based on saying outrageous, shocking things. The entire spirit of the show is born out of love. You know, I've really learned this from my Sufi teachers, from the sheikhs I've spent time with over the last 15, 20 years of my life. Actually, over 20 years of my life. Sheikh Hamza Yusuf is, you know, one of my main teachers, and I met him when I was 16 years old. So I've been with him for 24 years, and he has, you know, he's been an utter inspiration to me. I was in the hospital. We didn't even get to talk about this, but I almost died. I died basically on August 10th. I was hit by a car lying face down in the middle of Irving Park, and everyone that witnessed the accident thought I was dead.
Oh, God. Well, alhamdulillah that you are okay.
Did you know about this?
You know, it's funny. I had read a Facebook post about it, but I knew that your show was opening right away, so I didn't know that, you know, I didn't know how serious the situation was. I had just sort of briefly heard that that you had been in a car accident. Alhamdulillah, salamtak. I'm very glad that you're
yeah,
okay.
No, alhamdulillah. No, the recovery has been nothing short of miraculous, because to be a guy who ended up basically falling, you know, head first coming down onto the concrete, the middle of Irving Park, because I got clipped. You know, the man says he didn't see me. He drove into the middle of the street. I was waiting to cross the street. I was jaywalking, technically speaking, but he veered into the middle. He didn't see me. He says he hit me with an SUV. I went flying into the air, came head down, face down. I ended up suffering a fracture to my skull, to my left eye socket, and my cheekbone. I had a fracture on my left tibia, lateral tibia. A grade 3 torn MCL, a torn PCL. I mean, the fact that I was able to walk on crutches a few days later, was walking with a knee brace, you know, 2 weeks later, was walking without crutches 3 weeks after the accident, and began rehearsing my show for 6-7 hours a day. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, I think it sounds like you had a miraculous recovery then, because, you know, you're so energetic up there on stage, and that sounds like the amount of injuries that you had would have taken a long time to recover. So I think alhamdulillah.
Exactly. Alhamdulillah. I only brought it up because Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, I mean, this man is a saint, and, he, you know, he was literally calling me in the hospital.
Wow.
He sent flowers to my room. He offered to come to Chicago and be with me. And keep in mind, this is literally days after his own mother passed, Allah yarhamha.
Yeah, Allah yarhamha.
And so this is a very... you know, unique and beautiful and special, you know, piece of my life where people like Sheikh Hamza, Imam Zaid, you know, I put that post on Facebook. I don't know if you saw that, where I was able to consult with him. You know, this is a man who buried Muhammad Ali. This is a man who, Allah yarhamu, this is a man who was with Muhammad Ali for the last 5 hours of his life.
Yeah.
Holding his hand, praying with him as he was leaving this world.
So just a remarkable
And for him
person.
To even know who I am and be my teacher, my son Zaid is named after him. You know what I mean? Like, Dr. Omar is my sheikh, and he came to the show, and he saw it, and he gave me wonderful, beautiful advice and notes. So many other mashayikh, Sheikh Amin Kodwadia, Sheikh Tamim Ahmadi, Sheikh Nuh Keller, who's praying for me from what I'm told. When I was in the hospital, Sheikh Faraz Rabbani and the people at Seekers Hub in Toronto held a majlis and recited Yasin for this fakir. My other good friend, Umair Hasib, is in Fez, Morocco, telling me the awliya of Fez were praying for me while I was in the hospital. Sheikh Abdul Hafiz in Melbourne and his murids were praying for this fakir. So the prayers that came in from around the world, and not to mention the comedy community, the comedians that were hitting me up. Russell Peters is texting me. Hari Kondabolu is putting it out on the internet. You know, Hassan Minhaj is checking out on me. And I mean, just unbelievable amount of love from so many quarters of the different worlds in which this fakir is located, that I have to now believe myself that God, you know, left me in this world to do some work. That's why he didn't take me. And so the level of commitment, dedication, and energy that I'm trying to put into this show and make it something really beautiful, something really special, something that God will be pleased with, is unlike anything I've ever done in my career.
Alhamdulillah. And just to bring it back, I will say that I think that your recovery is not magic, but a miracle, because it was
inshallah,
from the
Ameen.
Will of God. So inshallah, Ameen. Alhamdulillah, that
Ameen.
You are well. But on that note, we actually have to end this interview, and it's been
okay.
so
Thank
wonderful
so
talking
time.
To you. Yeah.
What
so,
a pleasure. What
yes.
an absolute pleasure.
Thank
and What I do want to do, and just let your listeners know that so many of the things that I mentioned in passing, obviously they're Googleable information, but please do be on the lookout for the podcast that Brother Ali and I are going to go in full-scale preparation for after he's on a big tour right now. He's about to kick off. He just dropped a new album coming out in the next couple of days. I'm busy with my show for the this month, and then I'm actually. By the way, I'm also in a new Amazon show.
Oh, congratulations!
Amazon Studios. Thank you. Thank you very much. So I have a recurring role in a new Amazon show called Patriot. So I'll be going to the UK to film some. Excuse me, to Prague to film a couple of episodes. I'll be touring in the UK in October. So inshallah, 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 God willing, 2017. Brother Ali and I will be putting this podcast together. Wanted to put it out there with your listeners so they can know to be on the lookout for it, inshallah.
Oh, alhamdulillah, and thank you so much for being with us again. That was Azhar Usman. He has a show at the Silk Road Theater called Ultra American, A Patriot Act. It's running from September 6th to the 25th. Please get your tickets. This is an amazing, eye-opening show, and I think that you would benefit from seeing it. I think everyone out there should take the time out to check it out. Again, it's at the Silk Road Rising Theater, which is downtown. It's from September 6th to the 25th, Ultra American, Patriot Act. I think you should get your tickets now because I guarantee that it is going to sell out, inshallah. Thank you again, Azhar. And before you go, you should know Radio Islam is now hiring interns. Whether you have experience or are looking for experience, we have an opportunity for you. Radio Islam prides itself on giving interns an unparalleled hands-on experience, all in the heart of downtown Chicago. To find out more about our open positions in producing, social media, and database management, send us an email, producer@radioislam.com. You have been listening to Radio Islam, a call-in talk show from 6 to 7 p.m., 7 days a week on WCEV 1450 a.m. To find out more about tonight's guests and their work, hop onto soundcloud.com/radioslam1450, where you can also stream, download, and comment on our shows. The executive producer of Radio Islam is Abdul Malik Mujahid. Your producer for today has been the lovely Olivia Richardson. Thank you, Olivia. And our engineer this evening is Leonard Murphy. Radio Islam is a Sound Vision Foundation production. The views expressed and the views of the host and the guests are not of Sound Vision Foundation. Be sure to check all of our past shows at radioslam.com and connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram under Radioslam 1450. I'm your host, Jamila Shillow, and join us tomorrow evening for another great show on Radio Islam.